Regent Thomas, would you be kind enough to do the roll call?
Yes. Regent Bell.
Present.
Regent Roddy.
Present.
Regent Dennison.
Present.
Regent Hammond.
Present.
Regent Hale.
Here.
Chair Milliken.
Here.
Regent Nichols.
Present.
Regent Spiller.
Present.
Secretary Thomas. Vice Chair West.
Here.
Regent Terrence.
Here.
Mr. Chair, we have 11 regents present representing.
We have 100% today. Very good. Happy to have everybody that can be in attendance in person. Thank you for that. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes of the August 9th, 2024 meeting. Do we have any questions or additions or corrections about those minutes? If not, I'll entertain a motion that they be approved.
So moved.
Have a motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
Have a motion. Second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, like sign. Motion carries. The first or next item on the agenda is academic affairs. Regent Bell.
We have a brief agenda today, but an important one. And recognizing that students and faculty are the heart and soul of the university, our first item, which is our action item, has to do with some emeritus appointments. So, Provost Fisher, if you will. I'm happy to say we have several of those individuals in the room with us today.
Yeah, we're lucky to have four of those individuals with us today. I'd like to run through and just tell you about each one of them so that we understand the people and how great these people are and why they're becoming emeritus. The first is Dr. Sandra Audrey. Dr. Audrey joined WKU in 1988 as assistant professor in the Department of Government. She served the university with distinction for over 35 years, retiring in June of 2024 against my will. True or not? True. She has been a champion for civil and political engagement as well as dedicated professor. She also was recognized for her work to advance diversity, equity, and inclusion on campus in the Bowling Green community and throughout the region. And with that, she is here today for us, and if you'd like to say a few words.
Oh, okay. So here or?
And wherever you want to go.
No, thank you.
I can't
very
control
much.
You anymore.
Well, I noticed that I'm the only one here in jeans, and that's the privilege of being in charge. I get to wear whatever I want. Thank you very much. I've just got to, she said I could speak for a minute. So after 36 fulfilling years at Western Kentucky University, I am truly honored to be bestowed with the status of faculty emeritus. Reflecting on my journey, I am deeply grateful for the opportunity to work alongside such dedicated students, faculty, staff, and administration. Someone once told me that there is no greater burden than a great opportunity. However, my time at Western has never felt like a burden. Instead, it has been a remarkable journey filled with joy and sadness, but with purpose. I have cherished every moment spent mentoring and inspiring our students, witnessing their growth and celebrating their successes. It has been a privilege to be part of a community that values education and strives for excellence. Thank you for this recognition, which I will carry with pride as I continue to support WKU from this new chapter. Here's to the future and the lasting impact we can all make together.
Oh, beautiful.
The second person is Dr. Donna Sheese. Dr. Sheese joined WKU, I was closer this time, I hope, on August 7, 2022. She has been a cornerstone of the communication department, dedicating time and expertise to elevating the academic experience of the students. She always had a huge level of teaching proficiency. And in the letters that I read, one of the things they said is that she set the standard in the communications department for all areas, teaching, research, and service. And with that, I would invite you to say a few words.
I have just a little bit more than soccer. I'm communication. Thank you for inviting me to speak on the honor of the emeritus status. Although I'm not on the payroll, I still have three WKU students who are still trying to finish up their correspondence courses. And I also have 116 Chinese students in Jilin University, so I guess I'm not totally retired, but I'm so looking forward to January when I get to start jury duty. Although I was hired by Sally Ray in 2002, my connection with WKU began in 1997 when I enrolled as a full-time student. I was a first-generation, non-traditional, 40-year-old, single parent with two elementary-age daughters. I checked all the boxes for an at-risk student. However, failure was never an option for me. In the next few minutes, I'd like to tell you the three areas in which I'm the proudest. Those areas are public speaking, listening, and international students. So I was hired as an instructor with a 5-5 load. I never taught just five. I always taught at least six, maybe seven. Believe me when I say that first-year students are wonderful and a lot of work. The public speaking class is the bellwether indicator of the student's likelihood of success. It's also the class that most students are afraid of. That increases the challenge of helping students feel at ease in the classroom. I have many evaluations of students who said they lost their fear of public speaking in my class. That is the highest compliment I could receive. I served as director of the John Line Speech Contest. I volunteered to lead this since my students always placed in the top three anyway. Participating in the contest was a boost to the students' self-esteem and brought in proud family members to see their child in action. I also developed the online public speaking class in 2012. I developed it with Ann Honiger from DLO to make it interactive and easy to navigate. At that time, my dean was skeptical that public speaking could be taught online. However, when the classes were assessed, the online speeches scored higher than the face-to-face. Ask me later if you want to know why. When COVID came around, I was able to provide my Blackboard shell to other instructors who had not taught online and really didn't know how. I also served as a volunteer faculty sponsor for IABC, International Association of Business Communicators. We had a robust group and traveled to numerous conferences, visited corporate headquarters, and brought excellent speakers such as Regent Thomas to share workplace knowledge. Our chapter won the International Student Chapter Award in 2010, which I got to accept on their behalf in San Diego. Not only is public speaking my area that I'm proud of, but so is effective listening, my course that I developed. I traveled to the International Listening Association Convention and met with leaders over several years in research and teaching. I became a member of the board of directors and chaired the development of a listening certification called the CLP. I presented at numerous conventions. I was honored in June of 24 with the Listening Teacher of the Year Award. Students tell me that learning how to be a better listener has improved both their work and home lives. And finally, my love is the international students. I have to say that. I have a special place in my heart. It all started in 1996 when I volunteered at the International Center and my church sponsored a family. When I returned to school, I wanted to do something to give back to the community. That something turned out to be my dissertation in 2010, which was about the local Burmese and Iraqi refugees in Bowling Green and whether they had assimilated over the 10-year span through qualitative and quantitative methods. So it was natural for me to love working with students here on campus, a top for Novitas, and then Pathway. John Sunnygard was very supportive, and he does a great job for the students. Another international highlight was taking students on study abroad to Australia to study similarities between Native American and African slave experiences in Melbourne and the Australian Bishop Warrnambool. The 12-hour layover in Fiji wasn't bad either. I'd like to call the names of special mentors I've had along the way. Sally Ray, Cecile Garman, Randy Capps, Joe Kenjimmy, Rhonda Mars, and Dean Terrence Brown. Thank you so much, and I can't wait to see what's next.
The third is Dr. Carl Myers. Dr. Myers joined WKU in 1995 as an instructor in the College of Education and Behavioral Sciences and progressed to the professional rank of professor in 2015. He served in the field of psychology for nearly 30 years. He taught both undergrad and graduate courses in that area and was mainly school psychology, where he was identified as an awesome teacher in the letter that I read. And he is not here today, but if we could give him a round of applause. The third, or fourth, is Dr. Albert Meyer. Dr. Meyer served with distinction for 27 years from 1997 to 2024. He established an exceptional reputation as a teacher, mentor, researcher, and community liaison. He published extensively, I don't know the total number, I was trying to find it today, but I know at least 30 with students, which is really what this is about and what this institution is about. He's also taught with grace and assurance, served as an exemplary ambassador of his department and the university, and was recognized for his contributions by being named University Distinguished Professor. And Dr. Meyer is here today. Oh, he isn't. No, Albert isn't. Sorry, got the wrong one. I thought he was, my fault. And if we could call, we already clapped for him. That was mine. I marked the wrong one. Dr. J. Farley Norman served WKU for 28 years, who is the next person, from 96 to 2024 in the psychological sciences. He established an exceptional reputation as a researcher. He who has now 107 science articles, 5 books, and 87 of those articles were done with students, which is absolutely incredible. And as a student mentor, he's unmatched on this campus. He published heavily and taught well and was recognized also as a university distinguished professor. And he is here today.
Well, it's 108 articles. It's certainly been my privilege to be of service to the university and its students. I mean, that's what we're all here for, is the students. And I think that 90 individual students have published articles with me over the years. And I think it's a great thing that every single person in my laboratory who's wanted to go to medical school, PhD program, even law school, has been accepted with 100% success rate, and that's great for our students. And people keep asking, how do I like retirement? And I have to keep telling people, I'm not really retired. I'm still in my lab essentially every day, thanks to the university, right, the Ogden College of Science and Engineering in my department. I still have 7 students in the lab, and I'll keep doing research with our students for as long as I've got good ideas to publish. So, it's been a privilege.
And the last person is Dr. Bruce Schulte. Dr. Schulte served WKU for 15 years from 2009 to his retirement in 2024, pseudo-retirement, I think would be the term I would use. He established an exceptional reputation as an administrator, teacher, mentor, and researcher. He's published over 81 peer review articles, mentored many students, and was also recognized as a university distinguished professor. Dr. Schulte.
Thank you. It's fun being back in the room, and it's a pleasure to see everybody, and everybody so healthy and happy at this joyous time of year. I want to just take 30 seconds, if that even that much, to say something about Albert Meyer, who couldn't be here today. I came in as department head of biology, and Albert is probably one of the smartest people I've ever met. But he's also probably right up there with Norm as just a phenomenal worker with students. He just cares for them so much, always has, And that will be his legacy. Those will be students that will remember Albert for decades and decades. And he was just formative in that way. So sorry he couldn't be here today, but we wish him the best now and always. In terms of my own road, certainly enjoyed working with the fantastic Department of Biology and all the students, undergraduate and master students, the postdocs, the faculty that we had, and the college. We lost one of the deans that was my dean, Cheryl Stevens, a few years back, but she was a wonderful person as well and really helped me be a better department head. Then I got fortunate enough to be tapped on the shoulder by President Caboni to help co-chair the strategic planning process. And after we got through with that, he called me into his office again and said, I'd like to have someone oversee the implementation of the strategic plan. I said, I thought we were done with committees. He goes, well, you kind of are. And I said, well, who do you want to co-chair? And he said, no, I just want one head on the chopping block this time. And so I got fortunate to play that role for 5 years, work with Susan and the great team at SOF during that whole time. And also during my 15 years, both of my daughters graduated from WKU. My wife graduated from WKU. And this May, I joined them as a graduate of WKU, all four of us from the Potter College. So Terrence, if you ever decide to step down at dean, you know, I got the back right now. So I just want to say thank you, and I'm really glad to see, I'm so proud of this institution, that what we embodied in the strategic plan, the caring for each other, the use of critical thinking, the sustainability of our environment, become the tenets that we still move forward on. It's so important in this day and age to keep those things going and to educate our young and our old about those principles and those goals. So I'm just really proud to have been a part of the formative stage of this institution, and kudos to keep going, and I wish you all the best. Thank you for this honor.
One of the rare privileges that Regents occasionally have is to serve on a committee with people like Bruce and Sandra, which I had the pleasure of being on committees with both of them and seeing firsthand that passion and belief in this institution that they brought every day for all these years, as I'm sure all the others that we're recognizing today did as well. So I hope all my fellow Regents get similar opportunities during your tenure on this board. Any other comments? If not, I will call action item A1 for approval. Approval of the Emeritus appointments as described.
Dr. Bell, I was going to say I'm going to make the motion to do that, but you speak as serving on a committee with Dr. Audrey. I was a student of hers. Say that she was very instrumental, not only in me progressing as a student, but getting out of here. So I thank her for that, and I truly miss that you won't be around for future students.
I think Dean Brown has other plans for me, so I may be back.
And I'll make the motion.
Second.
Have a motion and a second. Any further comments, discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. Mr. Provost,
yes.
You have another
one. We have one information item, well, maybe two. The new Department of Society, Culture, Crime, and Justice Studies in the Potter College of Arts and Letters has been formed. Would you like to say something, Terrence?
Within DeKalb, we've been working a lot on efficiency and structure and trying to reimagine what the college looks like moving forward. Next year, we will celebrate 60 years of the college, and that will be a fun time for all of us to be able to look back and figure out what we've done well. But now we're trying to figure out what's the next 60 years of PCAL looks like. Part of this restructure is forming new units, and the new unit, SCCJS as we call it, has been hitting the ground running and looking at GMP documents, looking at how they can reimagine curriculum, experiential learning opportunities, and we think that this unit is going to be quite successful moving forward. So this is our pitch.
I have one other that I was asked to tell you about. We got our SAC COC report back, which is the 10-year reaccreditation. I would say it was a positive report, and we have a few things to answer questions of theirs, but I see no barriers to us not being reaccredited as we speak. And just to remind the board, they will be here in March, and some of you may be asked to participate in some meetings to answer some questions. So just a reminder, but we're working on everything as we speak. And with that, the last part of this is a faculty presentation by Marcus Brooks. And Dr. Brooks is a sociologist whose work examines how the laundering and mainstreaming of reactionary racist rhetoric in the media, and especially social media, influences public understanding about race and racism. And the title is Colorblind Nationalism and the Browning of America, Social and Political Implications for a Changing Nation.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for having me here, for Dean Brown, for asking me to represent PCAL and the new SCCJS department. So I'm going to use all of my time management skills and boil down my whole research agenda into like 8 minutes. So as Provost Fisher said, my research kind of focuses on how the ways that particularly in media, the way we talk about, understand race and racism influence public understanding of race and racism. And in particular, for what I'm going to present today, I'm going to focus on one part of my overall research agenda, which is looking at the concept of the Browning of America, or the idea that we are moving towards where we've historically been a majority white nation to a majority minority nation, and kind of thinking about the impacts of that. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today. Okay, so I'll save you the 1 hour lecture that I do for my students. So I understand, I'm sure everyone here understands what slavery and Jim Crow represent as kind of like temporal periods in U.S. history. But the main takeaway from this slide that I want to kind of point out is that sociologists kind of generally kind of articulate the United States having these three eras of racism that are shaped by the material conditions at the time, right? So politics, legislative changes, so we could, like the abolition of slavery to Jim Crow to civil rights era to where we are now as this era of new racism, which is this post-civil rights era where it's kind of understood that to racially discriminate is illegal, it's socially unacceptable, but the kind of presumption here is that racism still exists despite these legal beers, right? So then this kind of school of research looks into, like, well, what does this look like? Why does this still persist? So kind of the background of my work here that's kind of thinking about as these like temporal eras is that, so we've been saying we've been in this era of new racism since roughly like 1965, like that civil rights era, right? And the kind of like literature and scholarship on new racism kind of came into formation, like solidified about 25 years ago. So my kind of argument is that since that time, there have been major social, technological, demographic changes that warrant a reassessment of our condition of new racism that we have today. So I pull out three. I'm not saying that these are the only three. These are just the three I focus on in my research: is the dominance of new racism, the rise of internet and social media, and for this presentation, I'm just going to focus on the Browning of America. So again, we just can see here just for, as a visual. So this is the white population in the United States. So it's pretty steady until like the 1960s, which makes sense. That's our civil rights era. We have some pretty significant changes to immigration laws. So just the population demographic makeup of the country begins changing around this time. And then we see here just another graph demonstrating the rise of the foreign-born population, right? So the kind of Browning relates to not just like interracial pairing and childbearing, but also immigration. And then part of it also is, when you look at census data, is people changing their racial affiliations, like on census reports. So this is a concept that's been kind of like bandied about since about the 90s. This covers like from a 1990 issue of Time magazine. So this is something that we've been looking at, but as far as I can tell, we haven't really gotten a good handle on what this looks like. So that's what my research looks at. So just for the sake of time, I'm not going to go into like the full details of these projects, but these are two projects that I've published, and I'm in my third year now here at WKU, so this is representative of work that I've done while I've been here at the university. And essentially what these research projects look at is online discourse about race and, by proxy, racism. And what I kind of find, though, in this research and then kind of elsewhere is this kind of like changing in the way that we're talking about race and racism. We're historically, again, if we look at these eras, the new era of racism is kind of understood that with certain characteristics about kind of kinder talk about racism, that we don't necessarily talk explicitly about racism. And also implicit in this is a little bit of a political bifurcation, where it's kind of understood to be conservative or Republican is to have one kind of standpoint about race and racism, or to be more progressive or less left-leaning is another. But what I find in my research is something different. It's kind of a change in the emergence of a change in the racial structure that's focused more on ethnicity and nationality and not the historic black-white binary that we've had in the United States. So I developed this concept of colorblind nationalism, and I'll just read this here. So these are the four components in the definition of this concept I developed, that colorblind nationalism represents an ethno-nationalist populist ideology, practice, and a style of race talk. And race talk is just how we talk about race. That constructs solidarities between white and non-white conservatives based on shared political, economic, religious, and moral values. United in opposition to an antagonistic, un-American outgroup, those on the political left, which promises racial uplift based on principles of meritocracy. So again, what this colorblind nationalism seeks to do is offer an explanation for kind of like shifting of historic racial assumptions about political affiliation, right? Because historically, especially since like mid-century, it's pretty much been understood that majority for conservative party, it's majority white support, and while for Democrats, it's not majority black, majority of black people in the United States do support Democrats. But I'll show you also here just some little bit of preliminary data. My work is largely qualitative, so I'm not making an argument that these data are statistically significant. That's not necessarily something I'm concerned with, but I'm concerned with building a larger argument based on just kind of these ideological discussions that I'm finding. So if we take into the context, what is the material impact of the changing demographics? So if we see here, we're thinking about the shifting structures, think back to those time frames. So there's a few points that I've pulled out for this presentation is the changing and boundaries. So again, if we think about the black-white racial ideas that us in the United States are pretty familiar with, that is pretty unique. Like, the United States is unique for this black-white binary, right? So as we see this increase in non-white immigration, so folks from Latin America, so recent black immigrants from Africa, from Caribbean, they're coming in with different ideas about race and ethnicity, that are largely based on ethnic identity and nationality. And then we see here that there is some separation from native-born populations. And then finally, on this part here, just showing the kind of like the ideologies, right? Because again, so much of this in the United States specifically is built on this idea that there's been a schism between white and black America in so many different ways. But what these kind of show that there is actually a lot of overlap, specifically for conservative black Americans, in the ideologies and the ideas of how the United States nation should be, how it should operate between conservative black and white Americans. So these are just some of the things that I've kind of been arguing are part of that milieu that are creating these changes. So just a couple of data points, and then I'll wrap up here. So these are, and again, I'm not arguing significance, but just as part of a broader picture. So this chart here shows support for black men and women, and then Latina and Latinos from 2020 to 2024. And what you'll see in these two top four lines is support amongst all of these groups for the Democratic presidential candidate went down from 2020 to 2024, right? So there's been a lot of talk about the kind of like the racial breakdown of the election. So what we see here, even small changes, specifically like for black women, there's been a lot of talk about that, but it has gone down, right? And then inversely, the support for a Republican candidate went up. Two final points here. So if we think about part of the demographics, not just being immigration, but also age cohorts. So this top chart here shows that amongst younger black Americans, they have warmer feelings towards the Republican Party. Again, despite this racialized history of, like, if you are a black American, you are assumed to be a Democrat, right? That this is, there's some variation within the younger generation. And then finally here, if we look at this third chart here, this is foreign-born black men. So black men who are foreign-born, 30%, and this is 2020, voted for the Republican candidate. And if you notice here, if you, on this second line here, it goes back down to regular levels of U.S.-born black men in the second generation, so 10%. But again, there is something about the kind of ideologies that are kind of coming in here that are shifting these political orientations and kind of disrupting, in some ways, our ideas, our taken-for-granted assumptions about political affiliation, alliance, and so forth. So, thank you.
Any questions?
Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between religion and conservatism and black churches and Latino Hispanic religious views as well? Because I think it's integrated.
Yeah, no, you must have been looking at my computer hardware, because this is the new project that I'm working on is actually looking at kind of the idea if there's like a black Christian nationalism. So typically when we think about Christian nationalism, in the literature, it's assumed to be white, like white Christian nationalists. If you are a black person, you cannot definitionally typically be understood as a black. If you're black and a nationalist, you're a black nationalist, like in the kind of like Malcolm Xian tradition. So there is, and this is why I kind of reference the kind of like overlapping ideologies that we're finding in the literature, that these kind of like nationalist ideas that we associate with white Christian nationalism, if we take off the white and just look at the ideas towards militarism, towards immigration, towards family values, that population, specifically I've looked at like the black American population, that those who have higher ratings of kind of Christian nationalism ideologies overlap, right? So kind of the research that I'm saying, if there is not necessarily this material political benefit that black Americans are getting from the Democratic Party, right, which some would argue is the case, then that natural ideological overlap might bring this rise in kind of like a Christian nationalism cross-racially.
Other questions, comments? I'm glad we can talk about these things still.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
Chairman, that concludes the business of the Affairs Committee.
Thank you, Reese Bale.